Welcome to episode 2 of Counting to 5, a weekly podcast about the United States Supreme Court. On today's episode, we'll be taking an in-depth look at the 5 cases the court has scheduled for oral argument this week, but first, let's talk about what the court has been up to this past week. On Monday, September 26th, the court held its long conference, where the justices voted on hundreds of cert petitions that have accumulated at the court over the summer. In reality, there was likely little or no discussion of the vast majority of these cases, most of which had no real chance of getting granted by the court. The justices instead probably focused their attention on a much smaller set of cases identified by their clerks as raising issues of particular interest or importance, often because the lower court decided the case in a way that conflicts with decisions of other federal or state courts. On Thursday, September 29th, we saw the cert grants resulting from the long conference. The court issued an order granting certiorari in 8 new cases. This is pretty low for the long conference. It's not unprecedented. The court granted only 8 cases after the long conference in 2013, and only 7 in 2011. But when you put this together with the already low 29 cases previously granted, for 37 cases so far, we're on pace to have the lightest caseload in many years. Before I go on, I want to say a quick word about numbers. I've said that the court had previously granted 29 cases, but you may have heard or read elsewhere that there were 31 cases. Likewise, I said there were 8 new cert grants, but some are saying 9. Why the different numbers? It's the court's practice of consolidating cases. Sometimes when the court grants cert for more than one case raising the same legal issue, it will consolidate the cases. That means the cases will be heard together in a single oral argument, and normally they will be decided with a single opinion. For example, last year the court consolidated 7 separate cases involving challenges by religious nonprofits to the enforcement of the Department of Health and Human Services contraceptive mandate. The court heard the 7 cases in a single oral argument and disposed of them in a single order, so for most practical purposes they can be considered a single case. Technically, for this term, the court had previously granted certiorari in 31 cases, and added 9 more this week, but the earlier group included 2 pairs of consolidated cases, and the new group has another consolidated pair, which gives us the lower numbers, 29 and 8, for a total of 37 cases granted so far this term. I think the consolidated numbers are more useful for most purposes, so that's what I'll normally be referring to on this podcast. Now let's take a look at the newly granted cases. Before the new grants, free speech had been conspicuously absent from the court's docket, so First Amendment aficionados will be happy to see that the court has granted 2 speech cases raising very different issues. First, in Lee v. Tam, the court will consider whether a prohibition on registering disparaging trademarks violates the First Amendment. This case involves the lead singer of an Asian American rock band called The Slants, who applied for a trademark on the band name. The Patent and Trademark Office said that the term Slants is disparaging to people of East Asian heritage, and denied the application under a provision of the Lanham Act, the primary trademark statute, which prohibits the registration of a trademark that may disparage or falsely suggest a connection with persons living or dead, institutions, beliefs, or national symbols. The Slants have challenged this provision as a violation of the First Amendment. This is an interesting case on its own, but it's been getting even more attention because of the connection with the Washington Redskins NFL team. The Redskins' trademarks have been challenged under the exact same disparagement provision, and the outcome of Lee v. Tam may very well determine whether that challenge is successful. And this case, dealing with trademark registration, is now the 5th intellectual property case on the court's docket this year, along with the copyright case and 3 patent cases that I discussed last week. The second free speech case is Expressions Hair Design v. Schneiderman. Some stores charge a higher price when customers pay by credit card than when they pay by cash. The court will decide whether a state can restrict how the stores are allowed to describe this price difference. Specifically, under a New York law, it's fine for stores to refer to the price difference as a cash discount, but they're prohibited from calling it a credit card surcharge. Is this legitimate regulation of pricing practices or a violation of the store's free speech rights? Last week, I introduced Frye v. Napoleon Community Schools, a case related to the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, the IDEA, that asked when parents are required to use the IDEA's remedial procedures. This week, the court granted another IDEA case, Andrew F. v. Douglas County School District, but this case goes directly to the substance of the IDEA. The court is asked to determine the substantive standard that schools need to meet in order to comply with the IDEA's requirement to provide a free, appropriate public education to children with disabilities. One of the newly granted cases, McLean v. EEOC, deals with appellate standards of review. Specifically, when a district court rules on a subpoena issued by the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, either enforcing the subpoena or quashing it, and the district court's ruling is appealed, what standard of review should the Court of Appeals use? Should the dispute be considered de novo, that is, a fresh look starting from a blank page, or does the Court of Appeals need to give deference to the decision of the district court? The newly granted case Nelson v. Colorado adds another criminal procedure case to the court's docket for the term. When a criminal defendant is convicted and, as a result of that conviction, is ordered to pay money, such as court fees or a restitution award, if that conviction is later overturned, does the defendant automatically get the money back? Under Colorado law, a defendant whose conviction is overturned needs to sue under the state's Exoneration Act and prove his or her innocence by clear and convincing evidence in order to get repaid. The court will consider whether this system violates due process. The court granted certiorari in a pair of consolidated cases, Goodyear Tire and Rubber Co. v. Hager and Musniff v. Hager. These cases involve the limits on a court's inherent power to impose sanctions on parties and their attorneys for litigation misconduct, and specifically, the court is asked to decide whether the amount of monetary sanctions needs to be tailored to the harm caused by the misconduct. The court has added another immigration case to its docket. In Lynch v. DeMaia, the court will decide whether a statute allowing deportation of an immigrant convicted of a crime of violence is unconstitutionally vague. Finally, the court has granted certiorari in an Indian law case with the fantastic name Lewis v. Clark. This is a case about tribal sovereign immunity, an Indian tribe's power as a sovereign entity to resist being sued in court. The court will consider whether an Indian tribe's sovereign immunity extends to individual employees of the tribe operating off the tribal reservation, in this case, the driver of a limousine for an Indian casino. In addition to the newly granted cases, the court also issued a few other miscellaneous orders this week. First, on Monday, September 26th, the court granted the Solicitor General leave to participate in oral argument in three cases. The Solicitor General, or SG, is a high-ranking official in the Department of Justice who is responsible for representing the interests of the United States in the Supreme Court. When the United States or its officers or agencies is a party to a Supreme Court case, someone from the Office of the Solicitor General argues the case. In addition to cases where the U.S. is a party, of which there are many every year, the SG also participates in a number of cases as an amicus. An amicus, also pronounced amicus or occasionally amicus, is short for amicus curiae, which is Latin for friend of the court. It's someone who isn't a party to the case, but has an interest in the outcome, and an amicus normally participates by filing a brief explaining his or her views on the case. Occasionally, an amicus will ask the court for permission to participate in oral argument, usually because they say they have a perspective that isn't adequately represented by the parties. The court almost invariably turns these requests down. The one major exception is the Solicitor General. The SG often asks for permission to participate as an amicus, and the court frequently grants the SG's request. Monday's order deals with three cases being argued in the October sitting: Manuel v. City of Joliet, which is being argued this Wednesday, and I'll discuss more later this episode, and Peña Rodriguez v. Colorado and Samsung Electronics v. Apple, both of which are being argued next Tuesday, October 11th. For all three cases, the court granted the SG permission to participate in the oral argument and divided argument. Here's what that means. Normally, each side gets 30 minutes to argue their case. In these cases, the SG will be given 10 minutes out of the time of whichever party the SG is supporting. In another order issued on Tuesday, September 27th, the court denied an application for a stay in a case called Tilton v. SEC. This was a constitutional challenge to the use of administrative law judges, ALJs, in SEC proceedings. Unlike federal judges appointed by the president, who are referred to as Article III judges after the article of the Constitution that establishes the federal judiciary, ALJs are hired internally by the agency in which they work. There have been several legal challenges to the constitutionality of ALJs. This application, which the court denied, was by Patriarch Partners, a private equity firm, asking the court to block the SEC from proceeding with an enforcement action. The first oral arguments of the term are usually heard on the first Monday in October, but because of Rosh Hashanah, the first argument has been pushed to Tuesday. The court is expected to issue an orders list on Monday. The bulk of the orders list will most likely be the denials of hundreds of cases considered by the justices during the long conference. It may contain other orders of interest, possibly including additional grants of certiorari, but we won't know until it's issued. After the court has a conference, some cases get granted and others are denied, but close court watchers also pay attention to cases that were slated for discussion at conference, but are neither granted nor denied, but instead relisted for a later conference. Relisting a case is a strong sign that the court is seriously considering a case, and in recent years, a majority of the cases that the court ultimately accepted were first relisted at least once.
Then, on Tuesday, the oral arguments begin. The first case of the term is Bravo Fernandez v. United States. This is a case about the scope of the Double Jeopardy Clause of the Fifth Amendment. The Double Jeopardy Clause says, quote, "Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb." The basic idea behind double jeopardy is that once you've been acquitted of a crime, you can't be tried again for the same crime. The way this works in the simplest cases is straightforward. Imagine a defendant was charged with robbing a bank. The case goes to trial and the jury unanimously declares him not guilty. Then imagine the prosecutor decides to charge him again for the exact same bank robbery. Under the Fifth Amendment's Double Jeopardy Clause, the court will throw this second prosecution out. But let's imagine a slightly different scenario. Again, a jury acquits the defendant of bank robbery, but this time the prosecutor responds by charging him with assault. Okay, that doesn't seem like a problem. But wait, he's charged with assaulting a bank teller in the process of robbing the bank. Can the prosecutor do this? Probably not. In 1970, the Supreme Court decided a case called Ash v. Swenson. In that case, six men playing in a private basement poker game were robbed at gunpoint. Bob Fred Ash was accused of being one of the robbers and was tried for the robbery of one of the six poker players. There was no dispute at trial that the robbery had occurred. The only question was whether Ash was there. The jury ultimately acquitted him. Ash was then tried for the robbery of a different one of the poker players, but this time he was convicted. His case made it to the Supreme Court, and the court threw out his conviction. The court said that the jury, through its verdict, had decided that there was at least a reasonable doubt that the petitioner was one of the robbers, so the government can't try him for another crime that depends on the same factual question, whether Ash was one of the robbers. So that's the basic principle. If a defendant's acquitted of a crime, the Double Jeopardy Clause doesn't just protect him against being tried again for the exact same crime, but also for other crimes that the jury must necessarily have decided he wasn't guilty of. Now here's the first wrinkle. Real juries don't always have to act in logically consistent ways. In 1984, the Supreme Court decided another case called United States v. Powell. In that case, Betty Lou Powell was charged with several crimes related to a drug operation run by her husband. At trial, she was acquitted of some charges, including possession of cocaine with the intent to distribute and conspiracy to possess with the intent to distribute, but she was convicted of other charges, including three counts of using a telephone in furtherance of a conspiracy to possess cocaine with the intent to distribute. Powell's acquittal on the underlying possession and conspiracy charges was completely inconsistent with guilt on the telephone charges. If she wasn't involved in the conspiracy, she couldn't have used a telephone in connection with it, so she argued that the conviction should be thrown out. The court disagreed. While there was an inconsistency, the court wasn't going to look behind the jury's decision-making and wouldn't automatically favor the acquittals over the convictions. So the principle here is that it's perfectly okay if a jury at the same time acquits a defendant of one crime and convicts of another, even if, as a logical matter, being
not guilty of the first
would have made it impossible to be guilty of the second. But note that double jeopardy doesn't come into play here, because the defendant's only being tried a single time. Suppose instead Powell had been tried in two separate prosecutions. First, she's tried for possession and conspiracy to possess cocaine, and she's acquitted. Then she's charged with using a telephone in connection with conspiracy to possess cocaine. That's double jeopardy under the test from Ash v. Swenson. So if you think about these two cases, you can see that there's a tension here. We're going to bring these two principles together in a single case and see what happens, but first I'm going to introduce another wrinkle. Double jeopardy applies when a jury votes to acquit, but what if a trial results in a hung jury? In other words, the jury deliberates, but it's hopelessly divided and can't agree to either convict or acquit. Well, the rule is that a hung jury doesn't invoke double jeopardy. If a jury hangs, the prosecutor has the option of retrying the defendant for the same crime. If the jury hangs again, the defendant can be tried a third time for the same crime. Double jeopardy just doesn't apply. Okay, so consider the 2009 Supreme Court decision in Yeager v. United States. In that case, F. Scott Yeager was an Enron executive charged with various counts of fraud and insider trading related to his sale of Enron stock. After trial, a jury acquitted him of the fraud claims, but they were hopelessly deadlocked on the insider trading counts. The government wanted to try Yeager again on some of the insider trading charges, but Yeager argued that his acquittal on the fraud counts would bar the retrial under the Double Jeopardy Clause. On the one hand, a prosecutor can normally retry after a hung jury. On the other hand, if they had been tried separately, an acquittal on the fraud charges would have prevented a new trial on the insider trading charges under the rule from Ash v. Swenson. Back on the first hand, does it really make sense to say that the fraud acquittals necessarily mean the jury would have acquitted on insider trading when we know that they actually didn't acquit, they hung? And we know from Powell that there's nothing wrong with an inconsistent jury. Ultimately, the Supreme Court went with the second hand. For purposes of the Ash rule, a hung count is ignored. A jury has legal effect only through its verdicts. A hung count results in no verdict and therefore cannot be given any weight. So if Yeager can show that by acquitting him on the fraud counts, the jury necessarily found facts that would require acquittal on the insider trading, then he can't be tried again. Okay, so all of that brings us to Bravo Fernandez, the case the court will hear on Tuesday. Juan Bravo Fernandez was the president of a private security firm in Puerto Rico, and Hector Martinez Maldonado was a member of the Puerto Rico Senate. In 2005, Bravo and Martinez traveled together to Las Vegas to see a boxing match, and Bravo paid for the trip. In 2010, both Bravo and Martinez were indicted for bribery, conspiracy to commit bribery, and travel for the purpose of bribery, on the theory that Bravo paid for the Las Vegas trip in exchange for Martinez's support for two Senate bills related to the security industry. At trial, both defendants were acquitted of conspiracy to commit bribery and travel for the purpose of bribery, but they were convicted of the bribery itself. These verdicts were inconsistent, but we know from the Powell case that that's not a problem. But here's the problem. Bravo and Martinez appealed the bribery convictions, and they were vacated, that means thrown out, because the court's instructions to the jury had defined bribery too broadly. Usually, when a conviction gets overturned on appeal for something like bad jury instructions, the prosecutor can retry the defendant. And that's what the prosecutor here wants to do, have a new trial on the bribery charges, but this time make sure the jury instructions are correct. But the defendants say, hold on a minute, this is just like Yeager. A vacated conviction is just like a hung jury, it has no legal effect. The only valid verdicts were the acquittals on the conspiracy and travel charges, and under the Ash v. Swenson rule, these would prevent a new trial on the bribery charges. But the U.S. says, no, this is different. When a jury hangs, it doesn't make any decision. But here, the jury did decide, and it decided to convict. We shouldn't pretend the acquittals necessarily mean the jury would acquit on the bribery charges when we know that the opposite actually happened here. So those are the issues the court will be exploring at oral argument on Tuesday. The second case the court will hear on Tuesday is Shaw v. United States. This is a very technical case about the interpretation of a federal bank fraud statute. Lawrence Shaw was convicted under a federal statute targeting anyone who knowingly executes or attempts to execute a scheme or artifice to defraud a financial institution. So what did Shaw do? Shaw got access to a Bank of America account belonging to a man named Stanley Sue. Shaw set up a PayPal account in Sue's name, and using another account at Washington Mutual, he managed to steal about $300,000 of Sue's money before he was discovered. Shaw admits that he deceived both Bank of America and Washington Mutual in carrying out the scheme. So what's the problem? The problem is neither Bank of America nor Washington Mutual ended up losing any money. After the fraud was discovered, both banks took steps to reverse the transactions, and Sue got some of his money back. In the end, though, it was PayPal, not the banks, that was left holding the bag. The statute Shaw was charged under makes it a crime to, quote, defraud a financial institution. Shaw argues that in order to defraud someone, you need to deprive them of their own property. Sure, Shaw deceived the banks, but only to obtain someone else's money, not theirs. The government argues that this interpretation of the term defraud is too narrow. While Bank of America didn't have an ownership interest in Sue's money, it did have a possessory interest in that money, and that possessory interest is a property right that was wrongfully obtained by Shaw. So Shaw did defraud the bank, not of money it owned, but of the right to possess Sue's money. On Tuesday, the court will hear argument about which interpretation is correct. The court's first argument on Wednesday is Salmon v. United States, an insider trading case. Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 prohibits the use of a, quote, manipulative or deceptive device or contrivance. Is insider trading the use of a manipulative or deceptive contrivance? The court has said that it's not necessarily manipulative or deceptive to simply trade on the basis of non-public information. But in a 1983 decision, Dirks v. SEC, the Supreme Court said that this statute covers an insider who violates a fiduciary duty by secretly trading on non-public information. But what about a non-insider who trades on the basis of a tip? In Dirks, the court said this was covered by Section 10B only when the insider breached a fiduciary duty by tipping. And furthermore, whether the insider has breached a fiduciary duty by tipping depends on whether the insider receives a personal benefit for the tip. What kind of personal benefit? Well, obviously it's an easy case when, for example, someone pays an insider in exchange for non-public information. But what about not-so-obvious cases? Some lower courts have held that personal benefit to an insider can include the benefit one gets from giving a gift to a friend or relative. Under that standard, almost any tip could qualify. Other courts have held that the personal benefit requirement is met only when the tipper gets something of real value. That brings us to Salmon v. United States. Bassam Salmon's brother-in-law, Maher Kara, worked for Citigroup and had access to non-public information. Maher occasionally revealed inside information to his brother Michael, who then passed it on to Salmon, who traded stocks on the basis of the information. But Maher, the insider, never received anything tangible in exchange for the information. Rather, it seems that Maher gave the tips primarily to get his brother to leave him alone. Salmon was prosecuted for insider trading, but he argues that his trades don't qualify under the personal benefit rule from Dirks v. SEC because the insider, Maher, didn't benefit. The government argues that being able to provide a gift of valuable information to his family is more than enough to qualify as a personal benefit to Maher. Salmon, on the other hand, argues that personal benefit should be interpreted narrowly to include only pecuniary gain. The court is now asked to resolve this question. One bit of trivia about this case. The court received a number of amicus briefs, briefs from non-parties who want to weigh in on the case, and one of these briefs was filed by billionaire Mark Cuban of Shark Tank fame. Cuban himself was investigated by the SEC for several years for insider trading before being acquitted by a jury. Cuban favors a narrow interpretation of personal benefit, arguing that broad standards embolden the SEC and the Department of Justice to push the envelope with novel theories of liability. The court's second case on Wednesday is Buck v. Davis. The big question in this case is when a lawyer introducing racial bias into capital sentencing amounts to ineffective assistance of counsel, but that question is embedded inside some technical procedural issues. The case ultimately stems from Dwayne Buck's capital sentencing hearing after he was convicted of a 1995 double murder in Texas. In Texas, before sentencing a capital defendant to death, the jury must determine whether there is a probability that the defendant would commit criminal acts of violence that would constitute a continuing threat to society. This is known as the future dangerousness inquiry. At the hearing, Buck's lawyer put forth an expert witness, Dr. Quijano, who testified that Buck was not likely to commit future criminal acts of violence. In the course of his testimony, however, Quijano referred to several statistical factors that he said played into his future dangerousness determination. One of these factors was race. Quijano testified that Buck's race, Buck is black, made him statistically more likely to be dangerous in the future. The jury ultimately sentenced Buck to death. The later history of this case is complicated, but it's important to the question that the court will actually be deciding in this case, so I'm going to try to summarize only the most important points. In 2000, in connection with a different case in which Dr. Quijano had testified, the state of Texas conceded that the introduction of race as a factor in capital sentencing was a constitutional violation. Shortly afterward, Texas identified several additional cases in which Dr. Quijano had given similar testimony, including Dwayne Buck's. Texas later agreed to new sentencing hearings, waiving its procedural objections in the process, in every identified case except Dwayne Buck's. In 2004, Buck filed a federal habeas corpus petition, arguing, among other things, that his right to the effective assistance of counsel had been violated when his trial counsel introduced expert testimony associating Buck's race with future dangerousness. The court dismissed this petition because Buck had failed to properly raise this claim in his earlier Texas state court habeas petition. Various federal and state proceedings followed, and then in 2014, Buck made a motion in federal district court under Rule 60B6 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, asking the district court judge to reverse the dismissal of his original federal habeas corpus petition. Rule 60B6 allows a court to overturn a prior final judgment, but the Supreme Court has held that this requires a showing of extraordinary circumstances. Buck argued that his circumstances were extraordinary because, among other things, Texas had conceded error and allowed resentencing in all of the other cases involving Quijano's objectionable testimony. The district court denied the motion, saying that Buck had failed to show extraordinary circumstances, but that in any case, he had failed to demonstrate ineffective assistance of counsel. This requires saying a few words about ineffective assistance of counsel. Ineffective assistance is judged on the basis of a two-part test that comes from a Supreme Court case called Strickland v. Washington. First, the petitioner needs to show that the lawyer's performance fell below an objective standard of reasonableness. Second, the petitioner needs to show that if not for the unreasonable performance, there's a reasonable probability that the result would have been different. The second part is often called the prejudice prong, and that's where a lot of ineffective assistance claims fail. And that's what the judge here said, that the lawyer's introduction of racial bias through the expert testimony was completely unreasonable, but that in the context of the sentencing proceeding, it probably made no difference. There's one last procedural detail we need to explain. Normally, a party who loses in federal district court can appeal to the Circuit Court of Appeals, but in federal habeas corpus proceedings, the rules are a little different. Before a habeas petitioner can appeal, he needs to get a Certificate of Appealability, or COA. This is basically a court determining that the petition raises a legitimate issue. The appeal is not frivolous or a complete waste of time. The standard, according to the Supreme Court, is that the issues are debatable among jurists of reason. Here, when the district court denied Buck's Rule 60B6 motion, it also determined that its decision was not debatable among jurists of reason and denied a certificate of appealability. Buck then asked the Court of Appeals for a COA, and it also denied the request. And it's this denial of the certificate of appealability by the Court of Appeals that's now before the Supreme Court. So to recap, the underlying issue is whether Buck has a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel due to his lawyer's introduction of racial bias in an expert's testimony, but that's embedded in the question of whether Buck has shown extraordinary circumstances justifying overturning the dismissal of his original habeas petition, and that's in the context of deciding whether reasonable judges could differ on the Rule 60B6 extraordinary circumstances inquiry. It'll be interesting to see how much of the oral argument is focused directly on the racial bias and ineffective assistance question, and how much on these procedural questions. Wednesday's third case, and the final oral argument of the week, is Manuel v. City of Joliet. This is a somewhat complicated case about the precise constitutional remedies that are available for a prolonged pretrial detention resulting from a wrongful arrest. These are the basic facts according to the petitioner. Elijah Manuel was a passenger in a car driven by his brother when they were pulled over by the police. Police searched Manuel and found a vitamin bottle with pills inside. They conducted a field test on the pills, which came back negative, but arrested Manuel anyway. At the station, a technician did a second field test on the pills, which also came back negative, but lied on his report and claimed that one of the pills tested positive for ecstasy. On the basis of this false statement, Manuel was charged with possession of a controlled substance, brought before a judge, and thrown in jail. He was later indicted by a grand jury on the basis of police testimony about the pills. Manuel sat in jail until the prosecutor received a copy of a state crime lab report which showed that the pills did not contain any controlled substances, and the prosecutor dismissed the charges against him. In all, Manuel spent 47 days in jail and suffered considerable personal and financial harm due to being wrongly locked up. Manuel filed a civil rights action against the police officers and the city of Joliet. I'm going to refer to them all as the city for convenience, bringing a claim of malicious prosecution in violation of the Fourth Amendment. Here's where things start to get a little complicated. The Fourth Amendment protects against unreasonable searches and seizures. A police arrest is a type of seizure, and when someone is wrongfully arrested, they can bring an action for damages under the Fourth Amendment. This much is uncontroversial. Manuel could have brought a Fourth Amendment claim for wrongful arrest. But what's in dispute is whether he can instead bring a Fourth Amendment claim for malicious prosecution. Okay, so why didn't he bring a wrongful arrest claim? Actually, he did, but there's a 2-year statute of limitations, the time limit to file a lawsuit, and Manuel waited more than 2 years to sue. Then why would a malicious prosecution claim be any different? It's because of when the claims accrue for purposes of the statute of limitations. Manuel had a claim for wrongful arrest as soon as the police arrested him without cause and lied about the results of the field drug tests. As soon as that happened, the clock started running for him to file a lawsuit. But to bring a malicious prosecution claim, one of the elements, that is one of the things you need to prove in order to win, is the termination of the legal proceeding in the defendant's favor. This didn't happen until the prosecutor dismissed the charges and Manuel was let go, 47 days after he was arrested. So that's when the clock starts running on a malicious prosecution claim. So basically, the whole reason this case is in front of the court is the statute of limitations. Manuel filed his action more than 2 years after he was arrested, but less than 2 years after he was released, so he needs a claim that's measured from that later date. So what's the actual issue in dispute? The city argues that malicious prosecution claims can't be brought under the Fourth Amendment. A malicious prosecution claim requires the defendant to show that the proceeding terminated in his or her favor, in other words, an acquittal or dismissal of the charges, and remember, this favorable termination element is critical in order for Manuel's claim to be within the statute of limitations. But, the city argues, the Fourth Amendment's protection against unreasonable seizures applies to the innocent and the guilty alike, so malicious prosecution is a bad fit. A constitutional claim for malicious prosecution, according to the city, can be brought only as a violation of the Due Process Clause. But, says the city, there's only a constitutional claim for the lack of due process if the state fails to provide an adequate remedy. And here, state law, Illinois in this case, provides a remedy for malicious prosecution, so Manuel has no constitutional complaint. I mentioned earlier that the Solicitor General has been granted oral argument time in this case on behalf of the United States. Interestingly, although the SG represents the interests of federal law enforcement, in this case, the U.S. has sided with Manuel and is arguing that he does have a viable Fourth Amendment claim for malicious prosecution. The SG, however, is arguing for a high standard for pleading and proving malicious prosecution, which may limit its availability in practice. One final note about this case. Some cases come to the Supreme Court after a full trial where the facts have been sorted out by a judge or jury. In other cases, the key facts aren't really in dispute and the parties are just arguing about the legal rules that apply. But sometimes courts are asked to resolve legal issues while the facts are still in dispute. When that happens, the court and the parties have to assume certain facts are true for the purposes of argument. The briefs and court opinions will typically have a footnote explaining how the facts should be viewed. For example, here, footnote 1 in Manuel's brief and footnote 3 in the city's brief both explain that at this point in the litigation, the court needs to assume that allegations in Manuel's complaint are true. Manuel has alleged that he was wrongfully arrested, and the city is saying, even if everything Manuel says is true, he still can't bring a claim for malicious prosecution. Now, as anyone who has followed many lawsuits knows, it's not uncommon for there to be quite a bit of distance between the facts alleged in a complaint and the facts that eventually come out during litigation. Sometimes the plaintiff is unable to fully substantiate or prove all of the allegations. Sometimes the plaintiff's claims turn out to be completely baseless. And sometimes, once the facts come out, we learn that the truth is even worse than the plaintiff suspected and alleged. I mention this because here, Manuel has alleged egregious misconduct by the police. According to his account, dirty cops who had a history of harassing Manuel deliberately targeted him, violently beat him while taunting him with racial slurs, and then fabricated drug test results in order to have him locked up and prosecuted for a non-existent crime. It's certainly possible that everything happened exactly as Manuel says, but at this point, it's only an allegation from one side. Whenever you learn about the facts of a case from legal arguments or court decisions, it's always a good idea to pay attention to the status of those facts. They may be undisputed or already decided by a court, but they may also be unproven allegations, and reporters and commentators aren't always careful to distinguish. And that's the last of the court's cases for this week.
On Friday, the justices will have their private conference where they'll vote on the cases that were argued this week and discuss and vote on additional cert petitions.
With those cases out of the way, let's talk about the court and the news. There have been no new developments with respect to the court's vacant seat. It has now been about 200 days since President Obama nominated D.C. Circuit Chief Judge Merrick Garland to fill the seat, but as of yet, the Senate has taken no action, and at this point, it seems a certainty that nothing will happen at least until after the election. Perhaps surprisingly, given the vacancy, the Supreme Court was not even mentioned during the first presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. A few of the justices were out and about during the past week. Justice Breyer had three successive stops on his tour promoting his 2015 book, The Court and the World, appearing on September 27th in Baltimore, on September 28th in Boston, and on September 29th in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. The latter two appearances got some coverage from local press, but at least as of yet, no video of these events is available. The following day, September 30th, Justice Breyer appeared at Yale Law School for the inaugural celebration for the Paul Tsai China Center. On the same day, Justice Sotomayor appeared at the Animus Innovation Summer in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Finally, though not a physical appearance, Justice Ginsburg was interviewed in an episode of the What It Takes podcast from the Academy of Achievement published this week. NPR's Nina Totenberg interviewed the justice about her life and time on the court. This interview included a moving reading by Justice Ginsburg of her late husband Martin Ginsburg's heartbreaking final letter to her before his death in 2010. This coming week, as the court's official term begins, the justices don't have much in the way of public appearances, with only Justice Breyer scheduled to appear on October 5th at the 92nd Street Y to be interviewed by Charlie Rose. This is another stop on Justice Breyer's The Court and the World book tour. But first, this Sunday, October 2nd, marks the annual Red Mass at the Cathedral of St. Matthew the Apostle in D.C. The Red Mass is an annual service at which special blessings are given for judges prior to the start of the court year, and every year some of the justices are in attendance, so we can expect at least a few of them to be there this year. Next, I'd like to note some commentary about the court from the past week that may be of interest to listeners. First, an article by Adam Liptak in the New York Times discusses the very real possibility that following the appointment of a quote-unquote liberal justice to replace Justice Scalia, Chief Justice John Roberts would find himself in the unfamiliar position of frequently being in the dissent on closely divided cases. Liptak discusses how the Chief Justice might respond to that development. An interesting article in the National Law Journal by Anthony J. Franz and R. Reeves Anderson of Arnold and Porter discusses and charts the huge number of amicus briefs filed with the court in recent years and looks at how the justices cite those briefs. Following the court's release of the list of attorneys who will be arguing in the October sitting, Amy Howe of SCOTUS blog noted in a post on her own blog that fully 8 of the attorneys who will be arguing are women, including 3 from private practice, which is a significant increase from recent years. It's been much noted how the Supreme Court bar has become more concentrated in recent years, with a relatively small number of repeat players dominating the court's arguments. Some have expressed concern that this concentration exacerbates the lack of diversity among the attorneys appearing before the court. It remains to be seen whether these October numbers are just a blip or if it's part of a larger trend in the makeup of the active Supreme Court bar. Finally, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's new book, My Own Words, is slated to be released on Tuesday, October 4th, to coincide with the first day of arguments. This book, prepared by Ginsburg together with her official biographers Mary Hartnett and Wendy Williams, is a collection of writings by Justice Ginsburg spanning her career. In connection with her book release, Justice Ginsburg has an essay in the Sunday New York Times called Ruth Bader Ginsburg's Advice for Living, which is adapted from the book. A few weeks ago, on September 14th, Ginsburg also appeared on C-SPAN to talk about the book. This past week featured a slew of Supreme Court term preview events, but before I get to those, I want to mention a few older term previews available online that I missed in last week's roundup. First is a September 16th YouTube video preview from the Delaware Law School faculty. This video consists of a series of short summaries of upcoming cases by various members of the Delaware faculty. Then, on September 21st, the American Constitution Society held a Supreme Court preview at the National Press Club, featuring Garrett Epps, Kristen Clark, Nicholas Quinn Rosenkrantz, Carolyn Shapiro, and Paul Smith. Next, on Friday, September 23rd and Saturday the 24th, William & Mary Law School hosted a 2-day Supreme Court preview conference. This conference featured an all-star lineup of about 25 top Supreme Court advocates, journalists, and academics, with panels focusing on a number of different subjects, including business, criminal law, civil rights and liberties, immigration, and election law. The Friday session began with an excellent moot oral argument of Peña-Rodriguez v. Colorado, the case concerning racial bias in jury deliberations that's due to be argued at the Supreme Court on October 11th. If you really can't get enough of Supreme Court previews and you have the time, I highly recommend checking out this conference. Supreme Court preview events from the past week that are now available for viewing online include the following. On September 27th, the Federalist Society sponsored a term preview at the National Press Club featuring Tom Goldstein, Nicholas Quinn Rosencrantz, Carrie Severino, and George Terwilliger. Also on September 27th, the Washington Legal Foundation held a term preview featuring Jay Stevens, Neil Katyal, and Daryl Josepher. On September 28th, the University of Virginia School of Law held an event featuring Doug Laycock, Kim Ford Masri, Michael Gilbert, and Deborah Hellman. Also on September 28th, the American Bar Association's Division for Public Education held a term preview featuring Richard Wolff, Pratik Shah, and Stephen Wormiel. And finally, on September 30th, the Pacific Legal Foundation and National Review Institute hosted a term preview featuring Ted Olson, Neil Katyal, and Gregory Katsas. Also of note this week were two Supreme Court talks featuring Houston College of Law professor Josh Blackman. These weren't term previews, but are definitely of interest to court watchers. First, on September 27th, the Georgetown University Federalist Society chapter hosted a discussion titled Supreme Court Advocacy in the Obamacare Cases, featuring Blackman, Mike Carvin, Aaron Murphy, and Marty Lederman, and moderated by Adam Liptak. This event provided a behind-the-scenes look at the litigation of the Affordable Care Act Supreme Court cases by Blackman, who has written two books on the passage and litigation of the Affordable Care Act, and Mike Carvin, who was lead counsel on both the NFIB v. Sebelius and King v. Burwell cases, challenging aspects of the Affordable Care Act and its implementation. Then, on September 29th, Blackman gave a talk to the NYU Federalist Society chapter discussing how the coming Ninth Justice will impact the court's jurisprudence going forward, with comments by Samuel S. Stryker. Finally, in addition to these live events, there were a couple of podcasts this week previewing the upcoming term. First, the National Constitution Center's We the People podcast, hosted by Jeff Rosen, previewed the upcoming term with John Malcolm from the Heritage Foundation and Michelle Jawando from the Center for American Progress. Then, on Slate's Amicus podcast, host Dahlia Lithwick interviewed Supreme Court advocate and SCOTUS blog founder Tom Goldstein about the upcoming term. This episode begins with Lithwick interviewing former federal judge Shira Shinlin about Donald Trump's recent comments about the New York City stop and frisk litigation that Shinlin oversaw. Although last week was the big week for term previews and other Supreme Court events, there are still a few more coming up. First, on October 3rd at 4 p.m. at George Mason University's Antonin Scalia School of Law, the Supreme Court Clinic and the Federalist Society will co-host a Supreme Court preview featuring Supreme Court litigators John Elwood, Pratik Shah, and Jeffrey Wall. Then, on Saturday, October 8th, as part of the New Yorker Festival sponsored by the New Yorker magazine, Jeffrey Toobin, author of The Nine, the 2007 bestseller about the Supreme Court, will be giving a talk entitled The Supreme Court in the Post-Obama Era. And that's it for this episode. Links to many of the articles, videos, orders, and other resources discussed in this episode can be found in the show notes at countingto5.com. That's T-O and the number 5. If you have any thoughts or suggestions about the podcast, I would love to hear your feedback. Leave a comment on the show notes post at countingto5.com or on the Counting to 5 Facebook page, tweet at countingto5, or send an email to mike@countingto5.com. I look forward to hearing from you. Tell me what you liked, what you didn't, what's missing, and how we could do better going forward. This podcast is a work in progress, and your feedback will help determine how it evolves. If you've enjoyed this episode, please spread the word. Tell your friends, share it on Facebook or Twitter, and please consider rating and reviewing the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you subscribe to or download podcasts. If you want to help ensure that this podcast continues, please consider becoming a patron. Visit Counting to Five's Patreon page, and for as little as a dollar a month, you can help keep this podcast going. Please join me again next week when we'll be recapping this week's oral arguments and taking a closer look at the three cases the court will be hearing during the second week of its October sitting. Thank you for listening. This has been Counting to Five.